Well, we're going to come back to our friend, as we're calling him right now, Abram. We'll start calling him Abraham when God does. But in the meantime, we're going to call him Abram. And I want to begin with an observation that I'm afraid will be true about most of us as men, and that is that when it comes to women's emotions, most of us as men are at a loss. We are completely at sea, awash in the confusion of what we perceive to be irrational tears. Many of us hate it when women cry because we don't have the slightest idea what to do about it. We don't know why they're crying. We can't figure out. Surely there must be something we can do, but whatever it is, it's never worked. And so we keep right on going along, knowing we've done something wrong, but what it is, we do not know, even though we should know. And we have never figured it out. We feel confused, distressed, disturbed, frustrated, so we tell them, I hate it when you do that. Which means they only cry even more. And probably more than one of us inside kind of thinks that Archie Bunker really was on the right track when he said, stifle it, Edith! Although if we've tried that one, we know it doesn't work the way it did with Archie. Unfortunately, though, many women do learn to stifle it. Because they don't want to make their husbands feel uncomfortable and frustrated. And so they build that wall around those emotions. Now, if we're married, we learn that there are patterns to our wives' emotions. That there are appropriate times, at least appropriate across the period of time. We don't understand it, but we do know this is normal. This is regular. This is the way it works. We don't know why it works that way, but we do know this is what happens. Normal times to cry, normal times of expressiveness. At least, if they don't seem normal to men, there is a consistency about it. So we have some understanding of it. There also are other times when we realize, as men, it's perfectly proper to cry. Maybe even times when we're tempted to cry. Not that we'll do it, but we're tempted to cry. Times of joy when some great and wonderful thing happens. Times of sadness when a friend suffers or when injustice occurs. Times of concern when we're under great pressure and struggle mightily. This is especially true of us both as men and women if God has made us burden bearers for others. And so some folk walk into this room and you can just begin to feel the burdens that are. You can look across the room and you can see a person and say, that person is hurting. You can see just by the walk or by something in the voice or even in the smile, you can just sense the hurt and pain that's there. Now, the rest of us can't do that, but some of you can, and that's true of men as well as of women. And you are the merciers, those who have the gifts of mercy and compassion. And of course, tears come in response to the natural downs of life, fear over a child's illness. All of my sons have had some kind of very inconsequential fever, but I've had every one of them dead and buried. I can't remember how many times I've outlined their funerals. Hurt over an aging parent's gradual erosion toward death. How much that hurts to see that man, that woman we relied on that looked like a tree in the midst of a storm. Now the trunk is just rotting away and we know the roots are going. And it hurts us so much. Pain over the loss of a dream or the failure of a business. We've suffered over these things. I know that there are women, especially in today's world, particularly as you have grown up, primed and prepared for a career, for a profession. Now you've married, and now there are the restrictions of marriage and children. And there are some down times in your lives. when you grieve over the loss of that freedom, the excitement, the adventure. After all, it really is not very adventuresome to change a diaper or to drive a 7-year-old to school or to cover at a little league game because your husband's out of town. You remember when you were out of town. So there's some of those feelings that I think particularly women in today's society experience and feel. If a woman living with a man is living with a man who makes no real effort, she's married to a man who makes no real effort to understand her emotions, then she's very likely to regret ever marrying that man. She may become angry over it all, and if she does, that's when she stops crying. And I would say to you, the only thing worse than having a wife who cries and you can't understand it is having a wife who stops crying and you think you understand it. Because that's a false peace. And maybe even a declaration of war. And you may come home some night to a woman confronting you with papers in her hand and an ultimatum in her voice. For the first time, she may have found the courage to be able to say to you, to tell you what's really been bothering her all along. And for you, this may be some amazing shock. Where did this come from? It comes because of an inability to read the signs. But of all the things we could talk about that relate to emotions in a woman, few things create greater and deeper pain, and therefore stronger and at times unexpected emotion than the unfulfilled dream of having a child. In the heart of every bride, there is the dream, the expectation that someday she will be a mother. She's made her decision to marry this man on the basis of her thinking that he will be a good father for her children. And she's taking the great risk of entrusting herself, her future, her life, her being, everything that she is, to this man, and part of that risk is the dream that through him she will become a mother. I think in all of my experience in ministry and the times when I've interacted with people privately, with couples, some of the greatest pain I have seen has been in the lives of those who either thought they could not have children or could not have children, who have suffered a miscarriage. They come and sit and talk. And that hurt is so great. We are looking at a couple these days who face that very issue. It's amazing, isn't it, that when you come into the Bible and you start back in Genesis and you sort of blow the dust out and sneeze a little bit, how you discover the awesome, unchanged human emotions of a couple struggling to have a child who cannot have that child. That becomes the dominant theme of their lives. It doesn't matter how successful he is. It doesn't matter how much money he makes. It doesn't matter how great a house he can provide. It doesn't matter what challenges are there in her life. If she cannot have a child, whether it's her situation or his, if she cannot have a child, there is no peace in the heart nor in the home. And so we come into one of the most, to me, one of the most amazing and intimate conversations in the Bible, and as human as it gets, We are walking this morning, all of us, traipsing into Abram and Sarai's marriage tent. We are coming into some pillow talk. We are coming into a conversation that is private and painful, and into an event that is awesome in its revelation of human emotion, but even more so into an event that pictures marriage as it has been for so many for so long. A troubled woman and a missing man. Because see, Abram the man, a success everywhere he could possibly go, out on the streets, in the caravans, in the marketplaces, in making his trades and doing his deals and raising his livestock and managing his household affairs with his 300-man private army, a man who could go to war, a man who can negotiate with the best of them, a man who could enter into deals with Pharaoh himself, a man who could move among kings and leaders and princes and sheiks, is a man who was the missing man when he came home. Abram the missing man. He's the missing man in Genesis 12 because of his personal ambition, his career. But in Genesis 16, he's a missing man because of his ego. Flat out male ego. He's a missing man because of his ego. I've asked you, how much is your wife paying for your career? This morning my question is very simple. How much will our wives be paying for our egos? In Genesis 16:1, we read about a woman in pain. She's already paid a high price for her husband's career. She had put everything at risk in his direction. She paid a terrible price for being his wife. She had already left her family and all her roots and everything that she had ever known for one simple reason. I'm convinced at the end of Genesis 11, it says Sarai had no children. I believe that's what motivated her to leave the best of the best, the greatest city in the ancient world. And having just come back from ancient places in Turkey, I can tell you that though life was not as easy as it is now, it wasn't as tough as we might think in some of those wonderful cities. They had heat in the houses. And they had beautiful homes. They had wonderful settings. And though it's easier today, much easier today, still, it was pretty good. She had given that all up. And this promise had not yet come true that God had made. She had gone down into Egypt with her husband and had done what he told her to do and put herself at great risk. And still no child. So in Genesis 16:1, we read that Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. Sarai is a woman in immense pain. Terrible, terrible pain. And so she makes a suggestion in verse 2. Sarai says to Abram, look, that's what now behold means. Look, now I picture this as, you know, and I'm guessing here, but I think this kind of conversation tends to come at the end of the day, not at the beginning and not in the middle. You don't start your day with this kind of conversation. You're too busy in the middle of the day to have it. So I think it comes at the end of the day. It might even be pillow talk. Look, Abram, God hasn't given me any children. So here's what I want you to do. Have sex with my mate. Maybe I'll obtain children through her. Let's stop for just a moment. Understand what's going on here. She makes this suggestion to Abram. This suggestion is culturally acceptable. Everything that belonged to her slave belonged to her. If her slave had a child by her husband, that child was Sarai's child. This is surrogate motherhood in the ancient world, according to the ancients. This was commonly done. It was a commonly accepted practice. It was the way you went about having a child when you could not have one. Age would be advancing. By now, Sarai is not young. She is moving along in her age. And it is probably too late for her now. And so, she makes a culturally acceptable suggestion. But it's not spiritually acceptable. Because it is not God's choice. God promised the child, but God isn't delivering. Sarai's quit on God. She's through with him. She's not through with him in the sense that she'll join in the worship, I'm sure. She knows who he is. But after all, he appeared to Abram. He didn't appear to her. He's more Abram's God than he might be hers. And so she's basically just said, God's not doing me any good. So I'll take care of it. She took matters into her own hands. She was in absolute distress because she had no children. By the way, do you know what Abram means? Abram means exalted father. Can you imagine what it was like every time she said his name? I mean, there was no way she could ever forget it. There was no way she could ever get past it. There was no way this just didn't hammer and hammer and hammer and hammer at her soul. Not only did she think about it on her own, but every time she said her husband's name, she said, exalted father, and then she looked around. Imagine what it would be like to go down to the sheik's tent. New sheik moves in. Kind of passing through. Maybe there's a caravan party of some kind. Annual event. Caravan coming from Persia on the way down to Memphis in Egypt. And so they show up and they meet some new people. I mean, Abram was a man of great power and significance. He didn't have a party without him. So a stranger comes in and meets him. Abram, exalted father, tell me, how many children do you have? And Abram's response is, well, there's a nephew named Lot. What else can he say? Can't you feel the pain in her soul every time she says his name? When a woman longs to have a child, nothing else really matters. So, she makes this suggestion. You know, I'm sure she had cried a lot by now. Don't you think? I think she had. I think she would have cried a lot by now. In fact, I kind of imagine Abram had a faithful, loyal servant named Eliezer. And Eliezer was a man that Abram could trust with everything in the world. And I just imagine Abram going down to Eliezer's tent. He was kind of like the chief manager of all of Abram's affairs, I guess. And I can just imagine Abram going down there. One of the times when Sarai is just crying and crying, and Abram can't stand it. Please, Sarai, what can I do? How can I help you? I can't stand it when you're like this. I can't help it. I don't know where your baby is. He goes down to Eliezer's and he says, I can't believe it, Ellie. She's doing it again. Sigh and cry. Cry and sigh. She's asking me, where's our baby? I don't know where our baby is. I can't do anything about it. Why can't a woman be like a man? You know, Abram fails at this point terribly. He fails in two ways. He fails first emotionally. The thing to do in that pillow talk was to take his wife Sarai and pull her close and say to her, Sarai, if I can't have a baby by you, I don't want a baby. God said he would meet our need and I'm going to wait for him. But he didn't do that. He didn't do it. He didn't meet her emotional needs, and he didn't remind her of God, and he didn't meet her spiritual needs, because he wanted a son. Just like a man. Just like a man. He wanted a son. See, in the process of his own self-interest, and I believe a spiritual breakdown, Abram completely missed Sarai's needs. I think one of our biggest problems, men, in ministering to our wives, in leading them, and in leading them in compassion, not in power, in leading them in care and concern, not in control, but in reaching out to our wives, I think that we are far more often likely to act on our own than to trust God. I would suppose, I would hope, that none of us in this room would be engaged in an affair with another woman. But I think some of us may well be engaged in an affair with our careers and with our egos. When we fail to trust God, we also fail to support our wives' emotional needs. These two things go hand in hand, because we don't trust God with that which means the most to us, our egos. Let me ask you one question. How many women in their right mind, in their right minds, would say to their husbands, go have sex with another woman? And I realize that there are women in today's world, there are people in today's world, husbands and wives, who trade around and all of this. You know, that doesn't make sense. Why would you trade the security of a loving, nurturing, growing, stable relationship where you can come home and you're always welcome and it's always, you know, even in the times of stress and confusion and uncertainty, there's something there. There's a foundation. There's an anchor. There's a stability. There's a, even on traveling, there's a phone call home that's refreshing and encouraging and enlivening, even if it's only for a few moments. Why would you trade that? Sickness. People don't feel human. That's why they act that way. And there isn't any woman in her right mind who would say this and mean it. Now, I know it was acceptable in Sarai's day, and it may be a great idea, but at root, it certainly is not what she really wanted. And so we read at the end of verse 2 that Abram listened to the voice of Sarai, and he becomes the second man in the Bible who said, yes, dear, at the wrong time. There are right times to say yes, dear, but one of them is not when one's wife is hurting with deep pain and is making suggestions that don't make sense. I mean, the least we could say is, wait a while, hon. Let's think about that. Wait a couple days. We'll talk it over. Now, I started by saying that Sarai was a woman in pain. Well, I want you to understand something that comes next. Sarai now passes her pain on to Abram. And husbands, if we are getting pain from our wives, I'll tell you why. You understand the biblical teaching about marriage? The husband is the head and the wife is the body. In accordance with Ephesians chapter 5, Christ is the head, we are His body, so the husband is the head, the wife is the body. That is not a position of power. The headship position is a position of sensitivity. Just tell me, how many times do you try to overpower your body? You know, like walking through a wall right there in the middle where there's no door and you're just backing out, don't know where you're going, and ram your elbow up against the wall. And your elbow says, stop! Turn around, look! And you say, shut up! You do that to your elbow? That's what we do with our wives. When we are not sensitive. And I promise you, this is not an issue of vengeance. It's an issue of an innate response. Just as the body sends pain to the head when something is wrong, so wives will send pain to their husbands when something is wrong. It's not vengeance. It can become vengeance, but it's a natural response. This woman married this man to depend upon him as her head. When a woman gets married, she gets married in order to enter into a relationship of exchange of life and strength and wisdom. And she marries to become part of this man's being. That's why she marries. And if we send pain to our wives, it's automatic, it's innate, no matter how hard they may try otherwise, they're going to send pain back. They can't help it. Because it's a head-body relationship. So if you are receiving pain from your wife, though it is not exclusively a husband's fault, always, yet, very often, we participate in it by starting it, by being passive when we should be active. So Abram does what she told him to do. And look what happens. After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife, I'm in verse 3 of Genesis 16, Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband, Abram as his wife. And he had intercourse with Hagar. And she conceived. And look, when she saw she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. Now think about this for just a moment. Think about Hagar. Who was Hagar? She's an Egyptian. Where did they get her? They got her when they went down to Egypt in chapter 12 because Abram didn't trust God. That's where they got her. So they get down to Egypt. They get in great with Pharaoh. Maybe she was some wonderful prize of a slave. Maybe she was some significant slave. She certainly was in Pharaoh's courts when Sarai was the rising figure, the potential queen for Pharaoh. And to be given to Sarai was the greatest honor possible. Then came the day when all of the shame of the lie came down upon Abram and Sarai, and Pharaoh banished them out of Egypt. And she, who had once been somebody, though she was a slave, she was still somebody, is now packing up what little she has and traipsing out of Egypt in disgrace to spend the rest of her life living not in the grand and glorious palace of Pharaoh, but in a tent, no matter how nice, but in a tent in the wild frontier land of Canaan. And now, she is the woman, and Sarai is nothing. And so what happens next is that Abram feels Sarai's pain. Verse 5. Sarai said to Abram, I curse you. Well, that's the summary of the verse. Well, look what it says. May the wrong done to me be upon you. What does that mean? I want you to have all the pain that I have. I want you to experience all the hell that I'm experiencing. That's what she's saying. That's what she means. It's in that bitter, angry spirit. Why? 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 You know why? Because her husband did what she told him to do. Now, I can just hear the guys in this room saying to me, figure that one out. Figure that one out for me, will you? Explain that to me. If a woman says to do something, why doesn't she mean it? As soon as I do it, what happens? She's angry with me, furious. Why can't a woman be like a man? Well, they are. You ever see a job situation where a new opening comes up? It's a promotion. Maybe you want it. You want the job? You know that Jack is going to retire? And Sam, the boss, comes and says, who do you think I should put in there? Well, you don't want to sort of puff yourself up. So you say, well, why don't you put Bob in? He's good. So what's the boss do? Puts Bob in. What do you do? Go in the boss's office and say, what in the world are you doing? Look at what I've done. I'm better than Bob. Well, if you wanted the job, why didn't you say so? Abram feels Sarai's pain. May the wrong done to me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, verse 5, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between me and you. What's she calling God's judgment on him? And may the Lord demonstrate that I am right. And look at Abram, verse 6. Look, that's what behold means. Your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. What does he do? He quits. He flat out quits. He walks out. He walks away. He has absolutely no courage. The man who can go out and fight battles, the man who can go out and do deals, the man who can go out and be a man among men, is a missing man at home. He fails his wife completely because he misses her emotions. And he misses her emotions because he really expects her to be like a man. He misses her emotions because he doesn't make the effort to learn to think the way she thinks. He rejects the way she thinks. It's irrational. It doesn't make sense. To whom? Well, to him. And who is the judge of all the earth? He is. Who decides what sense is? Men do. He doesn't listen. In the passage that we shall study, Peter teaches us as men to live with our wives with understanding. It may be supernatural, brothers, but Peter says it can be done. So here's what I say to you this morning. The men in this room, married, engaged, hoping, learn to listen. Take the time to hear. Step back and think. Don't act on what your wife says specifically when her emotions are not a normal part of her pattern. When a wife starts to cry when she should not be crying, that is a sign of trouble. She is hurting. She may not always be right, but she is hurting. She is in deep, deep pain. And to ignore that pain is to accelerate your pain. To the wives, I would say this. As husbands need to learn to live with understanding, I would say to the wives, wrestle with how you can communicate better to your husband. We men are often sort of bottom line types. That's very hard for you women. You find the bottom line by talking your way to it, don't you? And we find the bottom line by just sort of sitting down and thinking our way. And we don't talk until we're at the bottom line. You start up here, we're down here. Men, we need to learn to walk with our wives through their trek to the bottom line. And at the same time, women, could I encourage you to learn to move to the bottom line a little more quickly? Even when it hurts you to do it. Try. You know, if husbands will give by listening and women, wives will give by moving more toward the bottom line a little more quickly, the next thing you know, you'll be talking with one another. That's dangerous. You're liable to really, you know, find out how much you love one another. Then you're really in trouble. Let me say one other thing, then I'm done. To singles. Particularly young singles. There's some here. Young singles live in a time and an age when you're scared to take risk. You know, young women are not going to meet very many young men who have learned what I'm talking about. Young men can say it. It's another thing to learn it. I'm married 31 years. I've made a little progress, but we never get there. So young women, you want to get married, you're going to have to take a risk on some young guy. Just make sure this young guy is in the Word, because that's your only salvation. Young men, if you want to get married, learn how to be patient, gentle, kind, compassionate, and all that supernatural. So you got to walk with God. Because the only place I have found any wisdom to help me be a husband is right here. And Abram's been a good friend for me. He paid a high price, but he's helped me. Brothers, how much is our egos costing our wives? Father, we need wisdom and strength and courage. Thank you for your grace. In Christ's name, amen.